Magic the Seat is the book. This is episode 4. A bit of a delay between episode 3 and episode 4. It's been about almost 2 years. And I thought it'd be a good time to get back on track with this podcast of the book because I miss doing it with my mom. My mom misses doing it as well. And I know we had talked a couple of times about rehashing it over the last couple of years. And then COVID kind of happened. So, you know, I put it on hold again, but I was saying to myself, okay, my mom's sitting at home, got nothing to do. You know, she's retired. Why not just give her a shout and do it over Zoom? And, you know, it's obviously not the same as being in person, but given what's going on, it's the best we can do. And I think it'd be fun to be able to rehash this podcast for, you know, people who have read the book and have some more questions. So, Mom, I guess the first question for you is, how are you doing with all this stuff, the COVID stuff? How are you handling it?
Well, as a shut-in, I think I'm handling it pretty well. I was not a person to go out and mix with a lot of crowds to begin with, so I have my little hobbies, and I think the way it's going, I am handling it very well.
Well, that's good. I'm glad you're doing okay, given the circumstances. And, you know, given your age and the fact that you do smoke, you are higher risk. So it's probably better that you stay, you know, away from crowds and stuff like that. And so I guess let's get straight into it. I had to listen back on the previous episode because I forgot what we discussed.
I bet.
So I listened back today and then I was like, oh, right. And listening back, I was like, wow, like there were so many things that reading the book, I had so many questions regarding some parts that you may have glanced over a little bit. So I think it's great for the people who have read it who might have had those same questions that we can break down some of these chapters. And also, as I said in the initial episodes, it's kind of me reliving my family history, going back in time to ask my mom some questions that we really never brought up when we were, when I was at the house or we were doing, you know, sitting down for Christmas dinner. Those times it's like, oh yeah, I had those little specific questions that we kind of never talked about. So it's me rehashing my family history at the same time.
Yes, it's good. And it's still good, Keith, that I could still remember. So I'm glad we're doing it now because a lot of times as people get older, they forget a lot. And my memory's still going quite well, thank you.
Well, that's great. I'm glad to hear. Okay, so let's get into it. And this is regarding the chapter, The Change. So previously, when we left off, and you probably forget because it was 2 years ago, but we were talking about how Dad had some extreme introversion. And it, to the point where he actually got in an argument with you, punched a wall, and, you know, faked breaking his hand to get out of going to your friend's wedding.
Oh, yes. I remember that like it was yesterday.
So in the chapter, you had discussed how Dad had, I always find it weird, like, do I, not having that same history with our siblings, I hesitate calling him Dad because he wasn't in my life. So, and I always, it's weird, like, trying to come at this objectively, do I call him Ken or Dad? So I guess I'm going to settle on Ken for now and we'll see what happens. But so you said, I'm going to read a little excerpt of the chapter here. Time passed and Ken registered a company under the name of Thunderbird Productions. He explained to me that this company would get him where he needed to be in order to build his empire. And when you said the word empire, I was thinking, okay, do you recall him envisioning, like, explaining to you exactly what that empire was? Was it like a full-scale production company you wanted to do? Or was it just really like a kind of this fake company to get his acting credentials and get him, you know, some acting credits? Or did he want to direct? Or, like, was he vague with you? Or was he specific?
He wanted to be an actor. He claimed he did a few things here in Montreal, but there was never any proof of anything. It could have been all in his imaginary wanting to be. I have no idea. I have no proof of ever doing any acting. So I think, first of all, he did it to make himself important, to get credit cards, number one. And when we did go to the States, he figured that would he could present himself with heads of this company just to get the door open to a lot of places. Okay, and he probably imagined himself acting and future directing, but this was all in his imagination, Keith, which I didn't know at the time. And figured, here's a smart man, he's going to get somewhere.
Right.
But it was all in his mind, all in his conniving mind.
When he talked to you about it, it was mostly just the acting, right? Like, he wanted to be an actor, that was his end goal?
That's right, yeah. He used to draw his gun in a mirror to draw faster and faster. I think he put himself in a lot of these cowboy movies. He was obsessed. He used to take up horseback riding. He was quite good at it. He imagined himself, and he was going down there telling them that this is what he was doing down here. It was all lies, of course. We never got to an interview because he turned around and no.
Okay, so
he came back.
And he wanted to be a Western actor. Like, or did he ever talk about what type of movies he wanted to do specifically?
No, but by his hobbies, I would have imagined it would have been in Westerns. Because this is all what he would do. Dress in jeans, cowboy boots, go horseback riding, practice his gun. He'd go to the gun range periodically and to practice his shots. So this is what I imagined at the time. And that was big in those days, the Westerns.
When you went to go see movies and stuff, was it primarily Westerns?
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Okay, and this alter ego of Daniel Parker, Dan Parker, do you know where that name comes from? Did he just kind of pull it out of his ass? Was it based on something or somebody
he
knew?
No, he pulled it right out of his ass, like you said. That came from nowhere, his imagination.
Because, like, Thunderbird Productions, I don't know if he was a fan of the Thunderbirds. It was, like, a show with marionettes. And it was, like, a kind of a action. Okay. So I thought that maybe came from there. And I was curious if that Dan Parker came from, like, somebody he knew or, like, somebody he looked up to. Okay.
It's just a name he came up with that impressed him. And he had to be other people to get where he wanted to be. Because he had to play a few roles to get the credit cards and et cetera. This is where he came up with. He had a lot of different aliases, a lot. At one time, 7 or 8. So many of them. I don't even remember half of them because at that time, it was so unimportant to me. I knew in a way he was making half of them up. I knew that. And I said, if this is the way he's going to get, and if he could prove he's a good actor, well, so what? But it got him nowhere. It was all talk. It was all talk.
You know, it reminds me of one of the, I don't have too many memories of him because I could maybe count on my hand the interactions that I recall anyways. But I remember one of my interactions, we were at a mall and he took me out for the day. And it was a clothing store that had been robbed by a shoplifter. And so I think he might have overheard something. And so he just randomly pulls out a badge and he said that he was Detective so-and-so from what, and he was taking down all this information. And then and I was right in front of him when he said it. And then he just kind of said, okay. And then whatever. And then left and then didn't acknowledge it. Like that interaction, pretending to be a cop, never happened. And I remember just being, I'm 7 years old at the time. I'm in shock. I'm like, what the hell is going on? Like, I didn't know.
Yeah.
What is he? Is he a cop? Like, what was it, CIA or something? Like, it made no sense to me. And
he pulled this once out. We were in a grocery store, and a woman was talking about her flight, her last flight overseas, and blah, 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 the weather, how she thought the pilot didn't control the plane properly. And he introduced himself as a pilot and then started to talk about air flights with her. I couldn't believe it. He's talking like he's a real pilot. She's acknowledging all this, listening with her eyes and ears wide open, almost kissing his hands that here's a real pilot talking to me. And here, I said, God, he's nuts. He's not all there. And he really believed, talking to her, he was a pilot.
Yeah, it reminds me a bit of the movie Catch Me If You Can. The guy who pretended to be a pilot and went and flew in a bunch of
That was him, all right. That was him, all right.
But you know, looking at that, it almost seemed like he'd be such a good method actor that if he's getting to the point where he's believing it so much that he's convincing people, like imagine if he actually used that talent for good.
That's why I say if he would have gone through with his interviews and that, I think he would have made a marvelous actor on that part of him. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, the cruel side came out later on in life, but you're right. He would have made a damn good actor because he actually believed that he was that person when he was talking to them.
It reminds me, and this we're going to jump a little bit because it's going to be on topic. But you recall an interaction when you were in California of sitting pretty close to an actor called Ron Eli. So you're having supper, and this is the guy who played Tarzan at the time. And
yes.
You're saying how you're sitting there having dinner, and you're saying, oh, my God, it'd be great to actually meet him. And then Dad just goes up and just starts talking to him.
Oh, yeah. He went right up to him and introduced himself as a producer who lived in Montreal who was looking for new actors. He had some good movies lined up. And then Ron Eli right away was so interested. He was with some little guy. I don't know whether it was his buddy or co-worker or whatever. So he asked us to sit down, and we had lunch with them, and Ron let my cigarette on here. I'm thrilled to death. And Ron Eli thought Kenny was going to hire him. He said he was very interested in working for him. He had never gone up to Montreal at the time. And they went on and on. Like, I couldn't believe what was going on. I said, this is not for real. But I went along with it because what was I supposed to do, you know? I was just shocked. And I just played the game, in other words. And I said, I don't know where this is going to go, but actually it went nowhere. He said goodbye. He never called the guy, and Ron never called him, and I don't know what went off there, but that's what he used to do all the time. All the time, Keith. Games were played through his whole life.
You know, and the duality of that, to be able to just walk up and bullshit your way to having sitting down with an actor for multiple weeks, when at the same time, he seemed to be a person with a really low self-esteem. And he was very, critical about his appearance and stuff. You had mentioned a couple times in the next chapter how he, whenever he'd be poolside, he'd be fully clothed. And he was, you know, calling himself Dumbo, the elephant. Nobody would hire him. So I find that duality interesting. That in one flip of a switch, he can just turn it on and be like this fake producer and get the allure of an big time actor. And then at the same time, have that mood shift where he had such low self-esteem.
That's right. I think he was never properly diagnosed, but I think he had multi-personalities.
Multiple personality disorder.
Yes. Yes. I really, when I look back at it all, I didn't see this at such a young age when I was in 19, 20 years old. I only had grade 10 education at the time, and I didn't see any of this, none of it. I just thought, hey, maybe this guy is going to be an actor one day. Maybe I was in love with him, and I had faith in him, but it all went downhill, totally.
Yeah, okay, so let's shift gears a bit and go back to the change. This is before he went to California. You had mentioned Eddie was talking about how he didn't have very many friends, but his friend Eddie seemed to be important to him, and he'd come over a couple of times a week. And you had recalled that when Eddie would come over, he'd really spoil him. You know, he'd be ordering food all this time, and you were frustrated at the time because, you know, you were focused on getting those bills paid, getting the furniture paid, and then saving up and heading to California. He had this dream of dropping everything and going, and you were like, okay, gung-ho, let's do it. And then you're getting mad because he's sitting there wasting a bunch of money on a friend. Was he always kind of generous and played the big shot when friends and family would come over?
Always. He was the one who paid for the meal. He was the one who brought in the treats. He was the one who had get me to dress up really nice and show off. I had a lovely body at the time, a gorgeous body. And he'd get me to wear tight clothes just to show my figure, show me off. Like, he didn't want to share me, but he was always showing me off, showing his house off, the new bedroom set, the new, buying the meal. This is what he did all the time. The nicest car, he had to show that off. And if we took a trip, he'd show the pictures. And he was what they call a big show off. Big show off.
So it was very much the...
And he would always do it to the underdog. Underdog. The poor ones he would help out.
Oh, interesting.
But not necessarily to help them, to show off.
Oh, just to get the acceptance, the praise.
Yeah.
So yeah. He was doing it for the wrong reasons. He was
for the wrong reasons, yeah.
He was narcissistic. You talked about how essentially he treated you like a maid, like a servant. How he would like sit there and read books, like kind of fantasizing about being a movie star. And then you know, reading, it kind of seems like you fantasized about having children. His plans were not my plans. Ken's only goal was to get to California, and mine was to start raising a family. You know, it seems to me that in that early in your marriage, you both seemed to be on such different wavelengths.
We did. To me, getting married, loving someone, sharing your love with raising a family, buying a home. But him, it was the total opposite. It was getting married to a woman, and him, it was not like sharing their life, their dreams with a woman. It was like owning that woman.
Right.
Well, I've got her now. She's mine. It's like a piece of furniture. They're going to do what I want. Furniture, he picked all the furniture. He just picked everything, the food, the furniture, everything. Even my pay, he had control of everything, every penny, every dime. Again, I didn't see it the right way. I knew something was wrong. I didn't like it. I used to argue about this, but he would say, well, next year, you're too young. Next year, next year. Next year turned into 6 years.
I'm trying to remember because it's been so long, but you know, when he was growing up, it was the same thing with his dad, right? His mom would just do everything, and was the dad very controlling too?
Oh, 100%. 100%. She always wanted a little part-time job. She had to wait till she was in her 50s before she could even get a part-time job. He always used to say, you know, the children, you stay home, look after the kids. And she had that white shirt for him every morning. He controlled everything, same way.
You say in the same chapter, first you say, I loved my husband, but my marriage was empty. And then you kind of question yourself, why was my self-esteem so low that I needed to stay in an unhealthy relationship? Now, is it possible in retrospect that you more that you lust, it was lust instead of love at that point? That
probably. Yeah, he made sex fantastic. He was a great lover. He read many books on the subject, and he knew how to please a woman. He knew. So this is probably all that it was. I knew nothing about sex. My parents, my mother didn't explain anything to us. Even when I started my period, she threw my older sister a pad and said, here, tell her what to do.
Figure it out.
I thought I was bleeding to death. I had no idea. You know? So this is what... it probably was lust there, you know that? Because, hey, you're hot and horny, you're a certain age, young like that, you know?
Yeah.
And being a good lover the way he is, a good kisser, wow, you know? That's probably all that it was. But we can't go back, eh, Keith?
No, absolutely. Forward. I mean, yeah, at this point, it's not regret. It's more just, you know, like, I was just curious what your frame of mind was.
Yeah.
Okay, so you said you were talking about having children and how he'd always shut down the idea, you said, for like 6 years. You say in the book, if Ken liked it or not, I was going to find a way to have kids. Now, what did you mean by that?
Well, I spoke to the doctor, I remember, and I said to him, the regular GP, I'd like kids, he wouldn't. He says, why don't you go and punch some holes in his contraceptives? I says, I don't know if I can do that, but somehow Kenny checked everything. Even when he used those, I couldn't pull that one on him. I knew that.
So he was checking for you to cut holes in them.
Oh yeah, he was. Even before I even thought of doing it, he was checking everything.
It must seem like
unbelievable.
Yeah, you know, and going back to the previous episode, he was, you know, he was checking on your when you're at working at Simon's, he, you know, drive you to work, check on your when you go for lunch breaks, and it seems like it must have been so tiring, like the effort that he'd have to spend.
There was no trust.
Yeah.
No trust on his part. None. He would place everything in his drawer a certain way, even measure the way he put things in between the articles. He would know if I went in that drawer or not. He would know. I'm telling you.
He called you?
I would wash it. Was put them away, and he knew right away what I did during the day, because you turned around and measured everything.
Okay, that's messed up. So we had talked about in the previous episode too, how, you know, he wasn't very keen on any kind of social gatherings, and he'd make up excuses like, well, if somebody said something, I have to get involved and be a big problem, kind of stuff. You say in the book that when the holidays came around, we always went to my mother's house. Now, curious for holidays specifically, you know, did he have did he make that an exception? Like, was he more pleasant during holidays? And like, how did he treat your family too? Like, was he like, okay, it's Christmas, yeah, let's get out and make an effort? And like, was he abusive, verbally abusive with you in the house, or did he like kind of make an effort to be more pleasant around your family?
Well, when we went out, he was very pleasant, very. And my father found him a bullshitter, because he would talk different things about the States. He had a wealthy friend and the land and that out there. But because my father lived there years ago, was married to a wealthy woman in California, my father knew he was a bullshitter. And he used to tell me he's bullshitting, but he didn't harp on it because it annoyed me. I didn't like it. But to my mother, he would butter up. So she sort of won that side of her, except when he did slam the door a few times and we had a little argument. But other than that, and he buttered one of my older sisters up and that. He would put on a good show. And my younger brother, to like him. He did.
Okay, so he played the charmer role when he went over for the holidays.
Yeah, oh, yeah, and he'd buy them expensive gifts. Definitely he'd play that. Oh, yeah.
And when your dad would say, oh, yeah, he's full of shit, like, that never resonated with you? You just were in denial?
I never told him what my father said, because I wanted to avoid arguments. But
no, I mean for you. I mean for you specifically. Like, when your dad would tell you. Any part of your brain was like, oh, yeah, maybe he's full of shit? Or just, you just...
No, so, I didn't even want to think of it. I thought maybe my father is... misjudging him. That's what I thought. Mm-hmm. Maybe he's misjudging. Sometime there was one little side in me says, oh my God, what if it's true? What if it's true? But then I'd shy away from that. I didn't want to believe it. No.
Yeah. Okay. Next chapter, California. 5 years have passed in our marriage. Ken had finally decided to make the move to California. What was the trigger that finally sparked that change for him, do you think, to make that jump finally?
To go to California?
Yeah. Because he had been talking about it for years, right?
Yeah, I know.
Well, what was why now? Why is this the year?
Well, he was successful with one of his letters to Dick Powell. It was a big thing on the television with the I Love Lucy show and that coming out, and Desilu production. And he hit a jackpot where he wrote as a Montreal producer, this and that. It was sending over. We had one of our great actors and was sending him over. And he hit the jackpot, like inviting him to come down. That's what pushed it. He said, I finally have a break. If he would have gone to those interviews, he had a few of them with different productions, he maybe could have made it. That's what pushed us. And we got our visas. We were all ready.
Okay. So you say Ken decided to stay the weekend and advised that driving all the way to Cali would be too uncomfortable and wanted to fly instead. So precursor, you drove to Toronto to say goodbye to your sister from Montreal, and then you were going to drive to California, right? He said, no,
yeah,
he drives, Yeah, he said, no, I don't want to drive. I'm going to fly instead. So what happened to the car?
Well, we just left it in Montreal, so we came back. And we flew. We left it in Montreal.
Oh, okay, I get it now. See, I thought you, but I thought you flew from Toronto. So you drove back.
No. We came back to Montreal, parked the car, and then we got our plane tickets.
Now, I remember you, you know, being a kid and you not being too big on flying. I know you haven't flew a lot. But I think I figured out why you didn't like flying, because you had talked about your first flight, how one of the engines failed and you almost had an issue. You had to fly back to the airport.
Oh, yes. Yes, one of the engines failed. So that got me terrified of planes.
One thing, though, was interesting. You write, I was so scared, but I never showed my fear to Ken. Why were you afraid to tell him that you were afraid?
I don't know. I wanted him to think I was strong inside, I guess. I didn't show many emotions to him. Even cried. I cried in private. I'd go in the bathroom and cried. I didn't want to show him these emotions, which was wrong when I think about it. It's so normal to cry when you're afraid or to let people know how you feel, to talk about it. I never did. I was quiet. Quiet. Maybe I didn't want him to yell at me. Maybe I didn't want him to think less of me. I really can't answer you the real answer to that, Keith. I can't.
Do you think it was because of fear of him, or do you think it was maybe the way you were raised, you know, to not show?
Well, that too. That too. You'd hear all the time, don't be a big baby. Don't be a big baby. It wasn't only men they told that to. Boys, they would tell it to girls too. Shut up. I don't want to hear you crying. I don't want to, you know. You were told to shut up if you cried. Shut up. You didn't want to hear you.
I find that interesting. I thought that was more for men. Yeah.
Oh, no. It was for both. Both. They didn't want to hear it. Both parents. Shut up and go to your room. We don't want to hear it. Which is wrong, eh? So wrong.
Well, no, absolutely. I agree. I just didn't know it was, I didn't know that women were, it was like,
Oh yeah. We were treated the same way by a lot of our parents. Shut up and go to bed.
Yeah. And back to the whole thing with Ron Eli, was that the first time that he like blatantly lied in front of you?
Where Ron Eli what?
The meeting with Ron Eli, Tarzan, when you sat down there. You're having dinner. And
yeah, that was the first last time, yeah.
Was that the first, like, direct lie that you were conscious of that was in front of you, like, that you witnessed directly?
No.
Okay. What was, like, a previous one?
Prior to that, there were so many of them that I really don't remember, Keith,
yeah,
on that part. Cuff,
yeah, I know. It's been a while.
He was multi-personality, this man.
Yeah. So you write, Ken's mood and attitude changed as the days passed when we were in California. He told me that it would be useless to go to any movie studios because he had gained so much weight and no one would hire him anymore. And the only role that he could be cast for was Dumbo the Elephant.
There was other reasons too.
Okay. What were the other reasons?
The money.
Okay.
When we went down, we took a loan to have extra cash. And his father had signed for this loan, which was, I don't know, $2,000-$3,000, which was a lot in those days.
Right.
And the first payment that had to be made, and the second, and we hadn't made a payment, so they notified the father and wanted the money because he was signed for it. And he told Kenny on the phone, and Kenny figured he had to rush home and take over this loan. I said, what? Lieutenant, we had some money, and let's get jobs, even if I get one first, and send them the payments from here.
Yeah.
We're far away. It would be quicker for us to do it from here than to go all the way back and get new jobs. We both had left our jobs. No, I got to go home. I got to figure something out. We can't leave my father responsible for that loan. He didn't make any sense to me saying that. None.
While we were in California, Ken received a phone call from his parents. They said that a bank inspector had come to the house and asking for Ken. Ken gave us some excuse to his parents so they could deal with the situation. To Ken's surprise, his parents that they paid the bank inspector. Well, he was furious. He said that he shouldn't have done that because he could have gotten away with not paying, but now he had to pay them back. I got a bit of a curveball for you because, you know, after that, you know, Ken says you're going back because you had to pay the parents back, right? In retrospect, in retrospect, do you think he could have been lying about the whole story in order to have like an excuse to go back because he wasn't happy?
That could be it, because I don't remember him paying the parents any money at all. That could be it, but I never checked into it. I was not allowed to go near his mail, go in the mailbox, go in his drawers. He measured everything. I had no idea what was being transferred or what phone calls he was getting. I wasn't allowed to pick up the phone half the time. I didn't know what was going on.
So, like,
I had to listen in doorways when we went over the parents when he was talking. I had to sort of put the noise down in the bathroom so I could hear what they were saying. I didn't know half the time even what he was saying to his parents.
Do you recall ever hearing the parents discuss the loan, like, directly?
No. That I could tell you. So that could have been bullshit.
Just listening to it, I'm like, okay, he's clearly not happy, right? He went on a whim. He didn't have the confidence to actually go and do these interviews, and he realized he's fucked up. And you know,
that's right.
He's missing. Obviously, missing home. He's calling his parents all the time. He needs an out in order to justify you dropping everything and going there. He can't just say, "Oh, I can't do it." He's got to find it out.
That's right. He didn't want to admit that. You're right.
To me, the out is this. I think it's all bullshit.
So do I now. Now that you see, I didn't even think about half these things. Even with you talking to me makes me know even more and more and more, because there was a reason he used to repeat to me sometimes. There's a reason, Anne, for everything that I do. Everything. And I thought, first of all, that just words. No, that was truth coming out of his mouth. There was a reason. Your other brother pointed that out to me, too. When he read the book, he says, "Mom, don't you realize everything he did, there was a reason for it?" You discovered that one, too, Keith.
I'm curious. I mean, we obviously can't ask him now. And even if we could, who knows what answer we would get, right?
That's right. Probably
must be
anyway.
Must be one of the most frustrating things. I mean, obviously, like, I'm not downplaying the physical and mental abuse, but just not knowing, honestly, not knowing the truth, for him just to one day just say, okay, yeah, I was full of shit with this, you know, to finally know for like the real truth about all of this stuff. Imagine like if you could go back in time and do it. All right. So we're going to leave it there, Mom. I'm really glad we're doing this podcast again.
It was a pleasure talking to you and talking to the public. Hello, everybody.
Yeah, absolutely. So I got to figure out a way for them that if they have any direct questions for you about the book or something, maybe specifically we didn't cover. The site is still marriageofdeceit.com. So there is a Facebook page there. And if you're listening to it, we'll find a way to get them to be able to ask me the questions, and I'll relay them to you if there's anything specific that they want to know. And that's pretty much it for this one. I appreciate your time, Mom, and we'll see you in a week.
Bye for now.